This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 29th of March. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han and Koo Soo Chuang here with me. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Jo-san.
You see? Oh, you can mix it up a bit.
No, it's just a one-trick pony.
Jo-san meaning good morning.
I think so. Also they say.
We'll get back to you on that one. I'm not sure.
Okay, over the next 4 hours on The Morning Run, we've got great shows coming your way. The Breakfast Grill today, Marvin and Price. He is the Director of Criminal Enforcement for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. We're very familiar with the DOJ, aren't we? But he's not from the Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative. That's the department that's investigating 1MDB. He's from the Antitrust Department or the Anti-Competition Department. He was here in town recently for a conference organized by MyCC, the Malaysian Competition Commission. Discussing a little bit about how the US does things and what we can learn in terms of best practices.
And in fact, we just had the MyCC head honcho here on the Breakfast Grill as well. I believe Julian, I interviewed him a few weeks ago, and you can check that out on our podcasts, on our website, bfm.my, also on our new app. But then it is interesting because, you know, I recall from that grill, there were distinctions to be made between, say, the government's policies to, you know, help foster and develop certain industries, as opposed to, you know, having anti-competitive behavior or cartel-like conduct, as you mentioned, right? So, yeah, it'd be interesting to hear what Mr. Price has to say, you know, as far as the distinction between how the U.S. classifies it versus how we classify it here at home.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction, because at what point does it become uncompetitive for governments to be involved in business and for them to be, you know, unnecessarily involved in business in terms of the people that they get to man those companies, right? Because obviously in Malaysia, there are a lot of monopolies in place. For example, the last mile of the telecommunication space, in defense, for example, in automotives, a whole plethora of our industry. So it's interesting, because that's a good distinction, but it's a necessary question to ask ourselves when it is to call time.
Yeah, well, Ahan, just to answer your question very briefly, from what I understand from my research, is that in the US, anti-competitive behavior is considered a criminal act. So it's a crime. Whereas in Malaysia, it's more of a fine, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm going to get him to clarify that distinction. I mean, in Malaysia, you know, you're slapped with a fine. I think if you remember in the early days, there was that issue with Malaysia Airlines and Air Asia. And then later on, in the most recent case, you had the PIAM, the General Insurers Association, with that whole kerfuffle with Bank Negara and MyCC.
So you mean in the States, it's jail time? Is that what you mean?
It's a criminal act. So it's you take it to court, a jury finds you guilty or not guilty. You can either, it means jail time, or it means a big slap on the wrist, or it means you being removed from your position. But it's a lot more severe, and it seemed to be a criminal act because of the impact to consumers. So, you know, at the end of the day, in the US, the individual is held above all, right? So by engaging in anti-competitive behavior, you are a detriment to society.
But, you know, I would think that with the US, you know, being the economy, you know, well, the largest economy in the world, you know, that they are obviously a lot more advanced and more developed. Whereas, you know, I'm guessing it can be argued that there is still room for development policies, right, and the kind of, not protectionist, but, you know, again, policies that aim to, that are targeted at specific entities or companies to help, develop that industry, right?
And one thing I would be really keen to explore in this interview is, you know, with the increasingly global nature of companies, as companies, you know, do business in multiple markets around the world, what happens when they engage in anti-competitive and cartel-like behavior? So antitrust enforcement will then also need to take a global element. So you have to coordinate with multiple jurisdictions around the world. If you remember, you know, things like in Samsung in South Korea, they did the multiple raids at the same time across many markets. Imagine trying to coordinate those kind of raids. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's precedent in the past few years, because remember when Microsoft was under the microscope? Sorry. and they were, you know, they obviously had a 90-something, 5-6% of 5% global market share
right.
of their Windows operating system, and they were charged. And I think they were investigated by the DOJ
right.
because they bundled Internet Explorer, the browser, along with us, and that was deemed as uncompetitive behavior. But that was a global investigation.
Yeah, so I'm curious to know more about how antitrust cases are becoming more global in nature. That will be on The Breakfast Grill today, guys. Marvin M. Price, Director of Criminal Enforcement for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. And after the grill at 8:30 in Current Affairs, we take a closer look at the new FAM president, the new Football Association of Malaysia president, the Crown Prince of Johor, Tengku Ismail Sultan Ibrahim. Now, if you remember last week, just before the FAM presidency elections, Tan Sri Anwar Musa dropped out of the running for presidency post, leaving TMJ the only contender, and therefore he was elected the FAM president. So the question is now, and hopes are very high, that TMJ can herald a new era for Malaysian football. Will he be the saviour?
Well, you know, obviously, a lot of men have come and gone, and they've tried. There's still a lot of problems with Malaysian football. The talent, the youth system, the non-competitive nature of the leagues. I think we've tried to go into the semi-professional space many years ago. We've paid relatively big bucks for international players to come to our shores. There's been many. I mean, international coaches as well. There's a lot of politics though. And there's a lot of shall we say, policy issues which are impeding this progress. And it's got to come at a time when, Malaysia's national football team is something like 175th rank in the world or something. It's, we're like three levels above Congo or something.
It's just
really, really disappointing.
Yeah, we are, 175th in the FIFA rankings.
Did I? Really?
Yeah, well done.
Well,
pretty
I just
good.
Made a guess. Bit of a stab in the dark, mate.
Well, I'll buy you a drink later, okay? but that is 100 places lower from our highest ever ranking of 75th back in 1993. Just doing a quick Google search here. But then also, when I was reading some recent reports about or post the prince's appointment to the FAM presidency, there was talk about how perhaps the Johor State FA or the Johor State government might actually funnel their own funds into FAM in order to help propel the development agenda on the national stage. So essentially, Johor's funds helping to develop football all across Malaysia. So that'd be an interesting development to see whether or not that does take place.
Yeah.
And if it does, can they be as fair and balanced as, the development agenda requires it to be, as opposed to, playing into the interests of Johor alone.
In case there's a conflict of interest, right? Well, we spoke to VJ Vic, football analyst at 442, about, TMJ's presidency. And he believes that TMJ probably has one of the most difficult jobs in the country.
He's actually been spot on about how perception needs to change. Everyone doesn't like FAM. It's everyone's favourite hero, or rather many people's favourite hero, coming on and taking charge of public enemy number one. It's going to be difficult, but if there's ever going to be one person who's going to change people's perception towards FAM, it's him. You don't have another candidate who look capable of changing the FA inside out except for him, and he's got the guts, he's got everything to do it.
Well, VJ Vic there pinning all his hopes on the Crown Prince of Johor to change Malaysian football forever.
He sounds like a football pundit.
He is a football pundit, yeah.
And then real quick, correction here. I'm looking at the FIFA Coca-Cola World Rankings. Apparently, we're now 161st. Google was telling me something else, but FIFA's official website is telling me 161st. So,
Google got it wrong.
Yeah, so 14th place is better from that previous 175th ranking, but still, far off.
Can I just say, I mean, apart from policymakers and on all the measures they're trying to introduce to improve the football game, a lot of responsibility also lies with the officials and the players, because part of the problem, I think this major component of the Malaysian football, what's wrong with it is because our players and our officials, we have been given this false sense of ability and this entitlement that is just one of the biggest malaises with the Malaysian
What do you mean false sense of ability?
We
think we can do it, but we can't?
Malaysian football players, local football players, and officials as well, we reckon we're crash hot. But without wanting to put in the effort, that's a huge amount of discipline that goes into the modern game. Your diets, your fitness regime, your attention to your personal physique, your skills, your training, even your mental space. And I'm just on some football blogs in Malaysia. That's one of the biggest problems, because the framework is there, kind of, but the people themselves are not putting in the hard yards.
Now, I recall an interview I did with Dato' K. Rajagopal, the former national football coach.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago. But, you know, I mean, while Chong, you raised some good points there, but at least according to Dato' Rajagopal, you know, he's saying it extends, the problem actually extends beyond just the footballing fraternity, but extends into Malaysian society as a whole. And what I mean, what he means by that is this, you know, like, essentially, say we take it from the grassroots level, right? Are parents really encouraging their kids to pursue professional sports here?
Well, it's chicken and egg, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Right? No, it's a chicken and egg thing, you know, because, you know, many parents, you know, being the stereotypical Asian parents, like, oh, study hard. No, when it comes to exam time, drop everything else, drop your football, drop all your fun and games, just, you know, hit the books and just stay with it, right?
Can I just say, France Football Magazine just released the player salaries and manager salaries. It's just last night, because I watch, I read a lot of football news. You
really?
Know
I couldn't tell.
Yeah. So Cristiano Ronaldo, for example, he's the world's best paid player. He earned £47 million in 2016. Mm-hmm. That's eye-watering, right? But he's also the most hardworking football player. The attention he puts into his personal ability, it's uncanny. He's like a machine, but he, you know. So what I'm saying is, like in Malaysia, officials and players, they want the glory, they want the power and the material gain, but they don't want to put in the hard yards. And that's the problem. Money's only part of it.
Well,
it's upstairs.
I wonder whether, you know, TMJ can instill that kind of mentality and mindset within something that's perhaps quite entrenched in Malaysian football, right?
Yeah, or perhaps broaden the talent pool and parents, you know, have your kids go play football.
But, you know, the comments I often hear from parents is a hot laugh, the duck. You know what I mean? How do you get too dark?
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It's typical Malaysian parents. But anyway, let's leave it at that. Sorry, I think this is dredging up some childhood some childhood problems for me.
I know some parents who are still like that. Hey, hello, it's hot outside.
All right, anyway, let's find out more on current affairs today, 8:30, as we explore Tunku Ismail's visions and challenges he faces in transforming Malaysia into, hopefully, what we can be, a highly respected footballing nation. Coming up at 9:30 on the S&M show this morning, Munim Salam, fund manager at Sertuna Capital, will be talking to us a little bit about how we can diversify out of Malaysia and into the fast-growing ASEAN markets. There you go.
Yeah, obviously he's going to come in via the Islamic fixed income and Sukuk markets, and, you know, getting investors to buy into the Malaysian bond scene. It's going to be a hard sell. I mean, he admits it. We've spoken before on S&M. You know, he's one of these dapper British-educated, you know, Muslim fund managers, you know, who's crash hot. Do you know what I mean? But it's a hard sell.
He's just full of accents this morning. Anyway, S&M show. That's going to be a good one. 9:30 a.m. But very quickly, guys, let's take a look at some breaking news overnight. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order called the Energy Independence Executive Order. Now, this will suspend, scrap, or put up for review more than half dozen measures which restrict the production of fossil fuels. The president says this would put an end to the war on coal and job-killing regulations. In fact, he was flanked by coal miners when he signed this order. So Donald Trump said, "My administration is putting an end to the war on coal." This is him announcing the change.
We have a very, very impressive group here to celebrate the start of a new era in American energy and production and job creation. The action I'm taking today will eliminate federal overreach, restore economic freedom, and allow our companies and our workers to thrive, compete, and succeed on a level playing field for the first time in a long time, fellas. It's been a long time.
I guess this is really him trying to change the U.S. narrative on climate change from Obama, who signed the Paris Accords, and now he's trying to undo all the, to change the narrative.
Yeah, what I understand from the climatologists that I've spoken to in the past, I think Obama did the right, well, not the right thing, but they advanced the climate talks to the point where succeeding presidents to Obama wouldn't be able to unravel the discussions that have taken place and the finalities of those discussions. I just find it uncanny that someone of Donald Trump's, you know, age and vintage would not be able to see what damage the climate, global warming has done to the world.
But, you know, this is no surprise. I mean, he has been a climate change denier for a very long time. In 2012, he tweeted, "The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing non-competitive."
He must be smoking something really, really strong. Sorry to be saying this in the morning at 6:15, but you know, what is he on?
Maybe all that coal
the
smoke.
The evidence is all around us, right?
You know, but at the same time, you know, it's interesting that he seems to be taking a stance whereby, you know, the environmental agenda and jobs creation in the U.S. energy space is mutually exclusive, though, you know, because you would think that you'll be able to perhaps, you know, focus on the renewable energy sector. But again, you know, what do I know? You know, he is the president of the United States. He's obviously, you know, signing into legislation what he thinks is right. And obviously, U.S. jobs is, you know, the priority right now.
Well, across the pond in the U.K., we are going to be seeing the Prime Minister, Theresa May, triggering Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty later today. This will then start the two-year process to negotiate the British exit from the European Union. It's essentially formally notifying the intention to withdraw, and it starts the clock ticking.
And so doing, delivering on the promises that Brexit actually, you know, promised, right? Because it's all about the UK's withdrawal and making a fist of it on its own. Mm. Yeah. It's obviously been detrimental to its interests, or so the narrative goes, being part of the European Union.
Now, and I also think that, you know, this would remove a major overhang over global markets, you know, and it'd be interesting to see how markets, you know, respond once that Article 50 is triggered. Hey, we got to watch and see.
It's 16 minutes past 6 o'clock. More with The Morning Run in just a few minutes on here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Psychedelic Shack by The Temptations. Good morning. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han and Kusi Chuang this morning, 6:21 right now. And guys, what did you study for your degree? Did you do arts or sciences? Did you do the humanities or sciences?
I was in RAW.
Oh, you in RAW?
RAW.
What's that?
A Japanese person's pronunciation of law.
Oh, my God.
That's what a stereotype is now. Yeah. It's terrible.
All morning, okay.
I had an admittedly useless degree in communications with a major in video broadcasting, and now I'm doing radio. How does that make any sense?
You see, that's ironic that you would say it's a useless degree.
Oh, my word.
Because according to, you know, I mean, that's been the perception, right, of a degree in the arts, a degree in humanities, has been seen to be less valuable than that in the sciences. But, and especially in this era of science, technology and data, are we seeing the decline of studies in the humanities? However, it seems now that Silicon Valley is putting a premium on graduates with studies in the humanities, because they're saying that, well, you can find, you know, an IT graduate a diamond a dozen, but you need someone who can understand how to translate that by understanding how people think.
Well, I'll take it one step further, though, because do you really need a college degree to understand, you know, like, say, the humanities, or, you know, learning the different cultures and values and, you know, philosophies? Because you would think that in the age of the internet, you can, you know, very much find that kind of information online. And I think the best way to learn about the humanities is to actually go out there and explore the different cultures and travel all around the world, right? So, I mean, essentially, because you would think that with an official college degree, it's for the, you know, recognition, that paper recognition that is required by specific industries, right? So does, you know, humanities actually require that paper degree, though?
Okay, so here's where the maturation of tech is, right? Because obviously we've come to an age where artificial intelligence and robotics are kind of like, you know, they're manning the machines already. So the base case has been established, right? It's the additional layer, which is where these people with a humanities degree come in. And this Forbes article focuses on this startup in Silicon Valley called Slack. And what Slack does is it's a business communication software which agglomerates all these productivity tools like Dropbox and Google Drive and what have you.
Yeah, it's like for teamwork,
collaboration. But the killer thing here is this lady called Anna Pickard. She's a liberal arts degree holder from the UK. I think she's about 38 years old or something. And she builds the intelligence behind the robot, which pops up on your screen to explain stuff to you. And the founder of Slack is the latest unicorn in Silicon Valley. Stuart Butterfield, he's the co-founder. He's a 42-year-old guy with a philosophy degree from Cambridge, a master's in philosophy, and a philosophy undergrad from Canada's University of Victoria. So they talk about how, you know, basically the humanity's mind is able to say, look, we've got the machines. Now we're going to build the stuff that will talk to you as a person.
Right. To understand how humans think. I had to come back to what Hans said about, you know, it's just a paper degree. You know, do you really need a degree qualification to understand the humanities? I disagree with that because I think there's something to be said about academic learning within, things you get without, you know, not just from Googling or Wikipedia-ing something, right? There's discourse and discussion and, you know, talking about ideas and learning to broaden your mind that comes from interaction, that comes from perhaps in the classroom or even outside the classroom from being among peers and other scholars, I think.
No, and I agree to a certain extent, but then I would think that today, you can have those kind of discussions and the kind of interaction, you know, I mean, outside of that structured four-year college experience, right? You know, so
Chirag Kutan and Ahmad Fuad Rahmat on night school. I mean, when the left brain guys and the right brain guys get together, you know, magic happens, right? But you've got a whole bunch of left brain guys. They'll talk around and around in circles like a dog chasing his tail. Do you know what I mean?
So you do need elements of the humanities, right? Yeah. So I think parents who are a little worried that their kids are, you know, not studying philosophy or art history or something may not be as worried because it's about the understanding the, you know, the big questions in life and being able to translate something like technology into a kind of a, you know, more relatable element of our daily lives.
And perhaps something else that we can draw from this article, you know, when the founder, you know, is boasting a degree from Cambridge or even...
Masters.
Oh, masters.
But both a lot of philosophy.
Whoa, masters.
night school stuff.
All right, so you got masters from Cambridge, okay? And also, I believe that a lady you mentioned...
Anna Pickard.
Yeah, Anna Pickard. She's got a theatre degree, you know, from Manchester.
That's right.
These are private and elites in the institutions, which also means that, you know, they've got other factors, other socio-economic factors that are going for them as well. And also, they got to have, say, like the cultural capital. They got to have the kind of, you know, family network. You know,
Think so? You think it's not just the ability to understand?
Yeah,
you know,
I doubt it's just that 4-year degree, you know, in humanities. Because I've, you know, in my travels as well, I've also met so many people who have come through with an arts or theater degree and are working at Chick-fil-A or working at Starbucks still, right? So, you know, you got to ask yourself, you know, really, what is the end goal here? Are you trying to improve yourself? And does that self-improvement, you know, warranted given the kind of student loan and student debt that you have to incur? Or, you know, is it about finding that, you know, ultimate job or being able to be a productive member of society in the career world?
So, you know, we often talk about graduate unemployment and the mismatch between, say, what the degree is and what the job, the skills the jobs are looking for, right? The job requires. I wonder whether, and I've heard, you know, many an Uber driver say, "Oh, I've graduated with a video game degree, a degree in video game design, okay, and I couldn't find a job."
So can I just modify this line of argument and say basically, do you remember Nicholas Nassim Taleb? He's the guy that wrote the Black Swans book, right?
Mm-hmm.
He followed that up with another seminal tome, and basically that book centered specifically in the ability to adapt in an ever-changing world, and that ability to adapt is the one killer thing that all human beings must have to survive and prosper in the 21st century. So if you've come from a theatre arts background from Manchester, right, and you make a gig of it, and you know, as a developer or kind of like one of the senior members of the management team at Slack, then you have succeeded in adapting yourself, and you have to, because you're not going to make it as a theatre actress. And she didn't make it as a theatre actress, but she adapted herself.
So likewise, you know, you can argue, using that same line of reasoning, the STEM graduates, you know, the science, technology, if they can adapt, you know, hence they can offer the kind of, you know, value that startups like Slack would want, right? So having that kind of humanities angle to it, right?
Well, it's the Elon Musk, you know, trifecta of being scientific, being business, and being, you know, understanding how people people make decisions.
Yeah,
right?
a lot of people don't realize that Elon Musk was basically an emigre from South Africa. He fled, and you know, today he's trying to put machines into people's minds. Yeah. Right?
So I have to ask a question: do you think a degree in the humanities is easier than one in the sciences?
It is, absolutely.
What?
It
John,
is.
Why? No, why do you say that?
No, because it is. I'm serious, right?
So studying philosophy is easier than a degree in programming?
If you're that way inclined. Because when I was in school, I did classical studies, you know, Homer, Chaucer, these kind of things.
And then what happened to you? I'm kidding.
Well, exactly, right?
So you do think so? Okay, why? Because it's...
Because if you can waffle, you can waffle. I mean, look no further than Sharad Kutan or Uma Pagan,
Andy
K. Pagan.
Oh, I disagree.
And you can waffle.
Completely.
You can go
I think
on
it
and
takes
on.
A higher level of learning to understand
really?
This. Yeah,
you
I do. I think if not, in any case, it's about the same level because, you know, there's something that requires... there's something about the mind that when you're studying the sciences, for instance, but also with the humanities, it's not for everyone. It is actually... about, you know, being able to think big, right?
So very quickly, Stuart Butterfield, the 42-year-old founder of Slack, mm-hmm. right, he said he learned two things from philosophy. Number one is to write really, really clearly, which is obviously an invaluable skill. The second thing was to follow an argument all the way from start to finish. And that's what he's been doing at Slack. So there are attributes to be learned from, you know, studying Chaucer.
Okay, there you go. Tell us what you think. Do you think a degree in the humanities is easier than that of the sciences? 016-201-9000 is the number to WhatsApp, and you can tweet us at BFM Radio. I've got Keith Kam now standing by with the first news bulletin of the day on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, Kusu Chuang and Tan Chung Han, A Kind of Magic by Queen. 6:40 right now, and a university in Canada, they will be hosting a masculinity confession booth, along with a number of other workshops and screenings to combat what they call hypermasculinity. Han, can you enlighten us what hypermasculinity is?
All right, so Google tells me that hypermasculinity is a psychological term for the exaggeration of male stereotypical behavior, such as an emphasis on physical strength, aggression, and sexuality. Chuang, take it away.
Come on, stop stereotyping people, okay? I think, okay, so it's not, I guess it's no surprise that this thing has come from Canada, you know, Canada, the land of lumberjack jackets and snow
and
boots.
Maple and syrup?
I have to tell you, he has been generalizing the whole morning, and it's equal opportunity generalizing also, I might add. No one is spared.
Yeah. There's no prejudice here. Everybody gets, you know, so is there a theme here? I mean, is there something which has precipitated this attitude? Is it Hollywood, maybe? I don't know. Well, certainly in Asia, we don't see hypermasculinity necessarily.
Really? You
I don't think so?
No. I do. I think it's growing too. This notion, well, I personally think it's masculinity is a myth that, you know, it's a cultural myth. What is masculinity, right? What is it to be a man? You know, do you have to be strong? Do
Does
you have to be unemotional? Does it mean you cannot cry? You cannot show
feelings?
Okay,
do you guys think Roger Federer is a masculine person?
Because he's athletic?
Well, for whatever reason. You know Roger Federer, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I would think he's masculine, but I wouldn't say, you know, he would be hyper, he would exude the hyper-masculinity that the University of Regina is trying to, you know, go against. I would think, you know, when we talk about hyper-masculinity, at least in the common sense, it would be like Rambo, right? It would be like, you know, the Terminator.
Like macho.
Right, you know, the Chuck Norrises, right? And, you know, I think, you know, essentially... The slippery slope argument would be this, that the masculine identity is under threat, that there is a merging of, you know, there needs to be this all-encompassing, you know, identity where, you know, everybody are just treated individuals, no longer defined and pigeonholed into specific traits. I think that's the, you know, that's to employ the slippery slope argument here, I would think.
Yeah, the traditional, I guess, definition of masculinity is one-dimensional, right?
Right.
Big muscles, swilling, you know, beer swilling, and, you know, basically grabbing women by the scruff of personal angle and dragging them into the
cave.
Yeah,
like the Neanderthal behavior, right? And I have to say, though, that to be completely honest with you, you know, I wonder whether this is an initiative taken by the university simply because of the rise in sexual aggression on university campuses. So the discussion about consent is coming up, as part of conversation in universities. And I really think this is a good thing. And I wish that, you know, we would have more of that conversation here in Malaysia, that we could teach our little boys, our sons, that what it means to be, and I'm using air quotes here, a real man. You know, more often than not in the Asian culture, there's this, you know, predetermined notion of what a man should, a little boy should grow up to be, how a man looks like in the views of society.
But
right?
But at the same time, you know, again, using that slippery slope argument here, admittedly, you know, like, shouldn't there also be an equal incentive to, you know, celebrate the distinctions between the male identity and the female identity, right? And it's not just biological, but also, you know, from the socioeconomic and also a cultural standpoint. You know, for example, what's wrong with the male being the breadwinner? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, women can be breadwinners or are career minded as well.
But I could see Melissa Edris.
I know. Here we go.
Yeah.
Again, I'm just employing the slippery slope argument here. But go on, Melissa.
But do you think that you mentioned earlier masculinity is under threat? Do you think that's true? I mean, is that something we're seeing in society, both in the West and here in Asia?
Okay. Well, I don't know about here in Asia, you know, but I will say that given my discussions with peers in other countries, you know, they have, at least in the traditional sense, you know, they feel their identities being under threat.
Can I just say I agree with Melissa Idris? Mm. Sorry, because
that's fine.
Which part of it?
Okay. Anecdotal evidence, when you drive on the road in the Klang Valley, some of the worst parkers of cars in the Klang Valley, bar none, have been male. And traditionally, in the old days, you know, used to be girls, right? But now I'm stuck behind this guy. He's trying to reverse park or side park into this block.
Right.
Turns out to be some bloke, right? And I'm saying, what kind of guy are you? So the thing is, I think there's a theme here because it's the rise of the female, right? This whole emancipation thing that began with women's lib in the 60s. You know, women are doing better in school and university, getting better grades, getting great jobs, you know, rising up the corporate ladder, glass ceiling being shattered in certain countries. Mm. So I think, yes, there is a threat to this whole notion of masculinity. And then at the same time, we've also got these South Korean males, you know, who are putting on makeup and going for cosmetic surgery. And, you know, I don't know why it's happening this way, but I think this is necessity to reaffirm the male.
Do you remember when it was people would tease guys who wore pink? You know, if you wore a pink shirt, you get teased at work.
Okay, Malik Ali loves to wear pink.
Malik Ali, our boss.
Is he any less masculine?
But I feel like we've moved away from that. And it was not that long ago when that was a case where, you know, you would be made fun of if you wore pink to school, you wore pink. If a guy wore pink, you know, you'd be like, oh, are you effeminate? Yeah.
Or man bags, or, you know, different accessories, you know. But then I think perhaps we can broaden this argument and perhaps, you know, ask the question, is there room for, say, positive masculinity versus, you know, this the negative connotations of a hyper-masculinity? So, for example, you know, being able to provide for your family, you know, and being perhaps, you know, or giving your family the luxury of being solely reliant on your income, for example, or being actually physically strong, or being actually... Okay. Like to take your kid out for camping. What's wrong? You went out for camping. Again, I'm just, you know, furthering the discussion here.
Okay, Daniel Craig in Casino Royale. To me.
Calm down, Chuang.
The fella can drive. The fella can fight.
He's James Bond.
Yeah, correct, exactly. Yeah. But the fella also can cry, lah. You know what I'm saying?
You know, that's a great
like Roger
point.
Federer. Do you know what I mean? So there's a soft side and there's a hard side.
Mm. That's a
like
great
Roger
point,
Roger Federer,
yeah.
Right? When he loses to Nadal in the Australian Open, the fella can cry. Mm. But when it comes to the... you know, 2 sets all, you know, 17-all in the tiebreak, and he can still pull off that steely determination to win that final tiebreak, right? So it's about everything.
I would
and
love...
speak six languages, you know what I mean?
So I would love it if society, we changed our mindset to be able to accept the idea that, you know, strong men can cry, or strong men do cry, and crying is not an expression of weakness.
And also having a strong man in a household or in society, it doesn't make it mutually exclusive.
So
you know? It doesn't mean that women have to be weak. You know,
so
I think that's the discussion right there. Right?
Are you a real man?
Whoa. Yeah, cry openly now. Okay, <we've... laughs> that was intense, wasn't it? Okay, Samuel Tan has tweeted and says, real men do chores at home. And I have to say, I agree with you, Samuel. Real men do do equal housework as well.
Hey, Sam, you want to come over to my house and do my chores very quick, man? I will, you know, call you a manly man right now.
Can I just say, a few years ago when we interviewed the EPF CEO, right, and one of the things he said on air during the interview, he said that, you know, my wife still asks me to take out the garbage and that keeps me real. So I said, okay, that's interesting. And, you know, I guess if you can manage the world's, one of the world's top 10 largest pension funds, as well as take out the garbage, I reckon that makes you a real man. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, way to go. All right.
And then shed a tear, at the same time.
No, openly shed a tear. Right? It's about crying openly, not hiding in the shower and crying.
I can't do that. I mean, I will shed a tear, but I'll just like turn my face.
Hide it, right, Chung? There you go. Real men, Chung, cry openly.
Well, if I may be vulnerable here, I cried at Les Miserables. You know, so
did you?
Yeah, I did.
Well,
so,
you're cultured like this.
I know. So, many men.
Does it count that I cried at Beauty and the Beast? Okay, it's coming up to 6:49 right now. We've got Grand Funk Railroad with Walk Like a Man on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.